This program was recorded at InterVarsity's Following Christ Conference, held in Chicago, December 27th through 31st, 2008.
Humanities Track, Monday, second session.
I will be making reference at the opening to the Power Losses article.
At the conclusion of his article, How Universities Contribute to the Corruption of Youth, Stanley Hauerwas argues that Christian colleges and Christian faculty ought to look intellectually distinct from their secular counterparts. Rather than replicating a cafeteria model of education which teaches that morality is a matter of consumer choice, Christian colleges, he implies, should organize their curricula to reflect and teach their religious and moral vision. In turn, Christian faculty should approach their subject with the aim of advancing that vision. This assertion invites us to act. How might our Christian commitment, in fact, affect what we do in the classroom, even what we put on our syllabus? Even at Christian institutions, the context I will assume given my teaching experience, we need to think about this explicitly. And I'd like to spend the next few minutes considering one possible answer. A primary task of Christian scholars in the classroom, as I see it, is to model Christian engagement with the discipline as part of the larger task of Christian cultural engagement. In our lectures, in our comments, in our assignments, we teach students how to analyze and appropriate elements of our disciplines rather than simply to consume or reject them. This modeling can take a couple of different forms, and I'll suggest two. One basic way to model Christian engagement with our discipline is to discuss contemporary scholarship from a Christian perspective. And we could call this a Christian mode, a Christian form of teaching the conflicts, a mode of pedagogy advocated by English professor Gerald Graff. Some of you may know his work. This mode of pedagogy brings scholarly disagreements about what constitutes appropriate disciplinary questions into the classroom. What recent developments in your field have changed the way your discipline is conceived? In English, its names are legion. We've got deconstruction, various historicisms, feminism, queer theory, postcolonialism, you name it. Bring that into the class and talk about it with your students. Assign some recent article that puts a new approach to the text you're reading into light, one that invites Christian critical analysis. Or assign groups of students different articles and have them talk about it and report upon it in class. This gives students a safe place to explore what might be intellectually and spiritually challenging material with a guide who can model possible Christian responses. If we don't show them how, as Christian scholars, as teachers, who will? An objection might be raised here, one that was put to me once by a colleague of mine, that teaching the conflicts turns the class into a discussion of approaches to literature or philosophy or history, rather than discussions of literature or philosophy or history itself. This is fair enough. There's enough to do in any class, in any course, without adding extra reading or meta-commentary. But one is always teaching an approach to literature. It's unavoidable, or philosophy or history. You're always teaching an approach. And I think it's best to make it as explicit as possible when we can. I think in our upper division classes, especially, it's incumbent upon us at least to flag for our students where Christians might differ from the prevailing academic orthodoxy, or to indicate that the approach you are taking in class is in fact different and why that matters. In other words, as Christian scholars, we should be as articulate as possible in our classes about the aims and goods of our discipline as conceived by the discipline and in light of our Christian faith. Sometimes these overlap, sometimes they don't. I think we should specify. I think this is important to do in general education classes as well, where we encounter students who may never darken the door of a humanities classroom ever again. This is our chance to say what such areas of inquiry are for in the scheme of things in Christ. Another, perhaps more radical way to model Christian engagement with our discipline is to read relevant models and then to imitate them in class together. This is Hauerwas's suggestion that we choose textual conversation partners carefully is a good suggestion. I have the opportunity in an interdisciplinary humanities course to teach Anselm's Proslogion, sometimes called Faith Seeking Understanding, a medieval philosophical text famous for its proof of God's existence. Those of you who are philosophers know about the ontological proof of the existence of God, right? And given that reputation, this proof of God's existence, it's unexpected in its form. The entire work is a counterpoint between formal philosophical argument and passionate utterances to God. This contrapuntal movement between proofs and prayer offers Christian students a practical approach to their studies. So I asked the students, what might an Anselmian approach to your work look like? How might your essays, your problem sets, your research projects feel different if pursued in this way? And the answers students give are often surprising. I had one student say, yes, I do this with my friends. We get together, we do a problem set, we pray. We do another problem set, we pray. Some people are already doing this. I'm like, hey, you're imitating Anselm here. Now, it's one thing to discuss this in class. It's another thing, as a professor, to actually do it. I have yet to actually discuss a difficult point in class, then move seamlessly into prayer, as Anselm does, asking God for further help in our discussion or praising him for some insight we have just discovered. I do say subsequently, perhaps when we're discussing another text, if we were having an Anselmian discussion about this text, we would stop now and pray. Now, the subjunctive mode is as far as I've gotten. Why? I have yet to do this because this offends our sense. This offends my sense of academic orthodoxy, of what I ought to be doing in the classroom. But I think unless we're willing to consider acts that do just that, that offend classroom orthodoxy, we will not move beyond replicating what everybody else in the academy is already doing. This brings me to an obvious and final point. In order to model Christian engagement with our discipline, we ourselves need to have a sufficiently critical relationship to our field. This is something, as graduate students, to cultivate now. This is like what we're doing right here. Especially since many of us, fresh out of graduate school, feel intellectually obligated to replicate current disciplinary trends in our classrooms out of a newly formed sense of fidelity to the guild. Major theorists, powerful advisors, have a way of hovering over our courses as a kind of invisible jury, ready to sneer or convict us of intellectual irrelevance or intellectual bad manners if we depart from current norms. I feel this myself. So getting distance from these powers and principalities, for that is what they are, or believing and acting as though Christ is Lord over them, which he is, praise God, and we've heard that this morning, is vital. It's vital for our own ability to model engagement in the classroom in a Christian way. Only then will we be free to be agents of difference as Christians in the classroom and on campus more broadly. And only then will we be able to train our students not simply to be critical thinkers, which Howard Wass critiques, or consumers, but intellectually alert, culturally engaged Christians.
Thanks. That was great. And you know what's interesting? I mean, listening to those remarks, I think it's interesting to hear the difference between. We didn't coordinate on this, so my comments have nothing to do with the classroom side of things. But it's also interesting because you know, Dora comes from out of an experience where she's been teaching at schools that identify themselves as Christian institutions. Mine does not. And there's also this difference that, you know, you're very early on in your career, and so I'm not thinking about the jury looking over my shoulder when I'm thinking about what's happening in the classroom. I could care less about the jury now. You know, having tenure, I do structure things the way I'd like them to go, though stopping and praying during class would definitely cross the line. My students would all walk out there. So that's something I couldn't do. That would be I mean, I could do it, I just think that was the strangest thing I ever saw. What's that guy doing? So you'll hear, I think, something that's a bit contrasted here, and I think that's really good. So I'm going to, I had some comments written out. I'm going to change them around a little bit. So here's the first thing that I think I would suggest for Christian scholars who are beginning to think about how they should participate in the life of the campus and make a difference there. This is something I do every year. I take out a map of my campus. I do this alone in my office. I take a map of the campus. I take a red pen. I draw one single line around the perimeter of that campus, and I pray about that plot of land. And for whatever reason, God in his wisdom has decided to plop me in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, teaching at Franklin and Marshall College, the small 2,000-student college. And he wants me to minister to the students and the faculty and the administrators who are there. I love some of those people. I dislike a lot of those people. But it doesn't make any difference. God's called me to minister to those people, and I want to be intentional about how I do it. I want to be looking for the places where God wants me to reach out to the people who are there And if I can't do that at the end of my sort of my yearly cycle of doing this, at the before I start this exercise again, if I can't answer for myself the question, how did you engage the constituencies on your campus for the gospel this past year, then I have really failed. I mean, I've got something to repent of and to do over. So I would encourage you to do that. God has given you a spot, and that's your plot of ground. And it's your responsibility to figure out how God wants you to engage the people who are there. So, okay, that was the end. Now I'll go back to the beginning. Last semester, Franklin and Marshall hired a new chaplain. And we've actually been without a chaplain for, I think, 6 years. We've had no one. In fact, I don't think we had an office of religious life for 6 years, which shows you how sort of barren the spiritual landscape is at the college. They, the administrators simply don't think in terms of the spiritual identity of their students or faculty. It doesn't hit their radar screen. It's very odd to me. But anyway, we hired this new chaplain, and so she wanted to get to know some of the faculty who had identified themselves as Christians, and so we got together. And at the end of the, this sounds like a self-congratulatory remark, but I don't intend it to be that way. But she said at the end, you know, I get the sense that you're kind of a spiritual counselor to a lot of the people of faith on campus. I guess there's some sense in which that's true. I mean, I have a lot of students that come by and, you know, want to talk about their faith and about things that are happening in the classroom, and I'll tell you more about that in just a minute. So, the spiritual counselor side. But 2 weeks ago, the philosophy club at Franklin and Marshall decided to sponsor a panel discussion on gay marriage. And they did this in part because there was a local pastor who had published an article in the Sunday newspaper about gay marriage, and it just set off this firestorm of controversy in the community. Every week for 3 weeks in a row, there were the whole op-ed page was filled with people reacting to this thing, most of them pretty angry about it. And so some people in the campus community learned of this, and you know, most of them were pretty unhappy with his remarks. And so this one student who led the group thought, you know, this is an opportunity for people in the academic community and in the local church community to kind of engage each other. So he wanted to put on this panel discussion. So it was, they brought this pastor in, a chaplain, somebody who teaches law and gender. There was a member of the German faculty who's gay. And it was me. I think that was it. And I think there might have been one other person, but I can't remember. Oh, I know. It was somebody from Lancaster Theological Seminary who writes on New Testament ethics. This is a small UCC seminary that's across the street from the college. So we got together and we had the panel discussion. A lot of people turned up. It wasn't very widely advertised, but you don't need much advertising to get people to come in the door for a topic like that. I was really trying to take the political philosophy angle, talking about, you know, how should religious commitments come to bear when we're thinking about public policy and civil matters. But, you know, as we got into the discussion time, people wanted to know, well, what's your view? You know, they didn't want to hear me just talking about... And so I said, look, you know, I guess I'll just come clean and say that I do think that the Bible teaches that homosexual behavior is immoral. And when it comes to gay marriage, I'm actually agnostic, which I am. I think this is a public policy issue that has to be settled on different grounds. Well, the chaplain didn't take too kindly to my saying that, and so she made some remarks that then set off this big emotional fireworks in the whole place. And anyways, she came up to me afterwards, and we talked for a little while, and she said, you know, I can see that you're sometimes a thorn in people's side around here. So I thought, well, I'm the spiritual counselor and I'm the thorn. And I thought, you know what, but that's what we should be. I mean, at least when, I don't know, I can't speak to what it's like to teach at a Christian college, but in a secular campus, that's what you should be. If people don't see you as filling both of those roles, you're not doing something that you're supposed to be doing. So I mentioned last night that a few weeks ago, a student came into my office very frustrated and said, you know, you won't believe what Professor X, the psychology professor, said. You know, more than anything else, I hope my son doesn't grow up to be a terrorist or a Christian. And, gosh, you know, one of my students said was, well, what am I supposed to say? I don't think those are bad lines of work. That's actually what she said. And so we talked about that. You know, when I was an undergraduate, I was a philosophy major, and there was one philosophy professor in the department who was extremely hostile to religious belief. Every course that he taught had some religious angle to it, and he would constantly harass and challenge the students. And one thing he said to his intro classes was, if you can find someone to come in and defend religious belief or theism from a philosophical perspective, I'll give them the whole class to do it. They can have the whole class. I'll just sit in the back and I won't say anything. And, you know, nobody ever did it. And so it was this unanswered challenge. And my roommate, who was a student in the class when I was a philosophy major, came to me and said, well, why don't you do it? And so I said, well, I don't know. You know, I'm only a junior philosophy major. I'm not really sure I'm up to it. But I did go talk to him. And I wanted to see if he was really serious about it, you know, if he would really do it. And I honestly only remember one sentence of what he said during that conversation. It was this. He said, it's one of my goals that every one of my students leave my class as an atheist. That's what I said. What? I mean, I don't remember what happened after that because I couldn't think straight. It was like it was a dream. I couldn't believe somebody was really saying that. But I really remember thinking that when I walked out of there, boy, it would sure be nice if there was some like Christian professor I could go talk to just to debrief on this. You know, I don't understand where, how someone could think that sort of thing or have that as part of their ambition. But I sure wished I had somebody on campus who was a Christian faculty mentor that I could go to and talk about things. And I didn't have one. So when I returned to the secular campus, I wanted to be that sort of person for the students who were there. And I think that, you know, there are a lot of Christian faculty I know who are on secular campuses that don't make themselves known to the Christian fellowship groups that are there. And I think that's really unfortunate. I think one of the first things that you should do, and something you should do regularly, is to try to engage with the student ministries that are on your campus. This can be difficult. And by the way, this is something InterVarsity needs to work on because undergraduate staff do not know how to productively engage Christian faculty. That's a real problem. And we need to think about how to fix that. But whether they know how to do it or not, you need to do that. You need to let them know that you're their ally and that you can be their advocate. And you will find students coming into your office sometimes to have really interesting intellectual discussions and sometimes just plopping down in the chair, downtrodden and weary and feeling like they need somebody to vent to. So be there and keep your door open. Have a bowl of M&Ms on your desk or something, right, that makes them feel like, hey, you want people to come in and talk to you. Now, there are times when you have to close the door. You can't get things done when people are constantly dropping in. Okay, I understand that. But saying to yourself, I'm going to set aside part of my time and not finish that article today so that I can have the opportunity to minister to these students who really need to talk to me, I think is important. But then there's the thorn part. And you know, that plays itself out in lots of different ways. On the secular campus, you could spend all your time shooting off your mouth and making enemies, trying to oppose things. And there are some people that do that. This is not a recipe for successful outreach to your campus. But there are times when you can't keep your mouth shut. And when you find those times, and you have to pick them strategically, and I think you have to do it with prayer and with some insight, and hopefully some other colleagues that can keep you in line, you have to move forward, even when it puts you at risk in some way. So I'll give you one example. I have a bunch of examples. You can ask me about more, but here's one that happened fairly recently. I was telling Jim Hoover about this, but there's a part of the story I didn't tell you. So we had, there's this institute that was founded on our campus by a guy who's, he lives in the community, he's very wealthy, he has no kids, he's got a lot of money, he doesn't know what to do with, and so he decided to donate $1 million to the college to set up this institute. The title of which was the Institute for Rational Thought and Inquiry. Now, maybe that means something to you, or maybe it doesn't. But there's an organization in New York called the Something for Rational Thought and Inquiry. They publish the Skeptical Inquirer and other things like that. And there are people who think that somehow science ought to be used as a stick to beat religious people. And that's what he wanted the Institute to do, honestly. I mean, I know this person personally, and he wanted this to be a mouthpiece for anti-religious rhetoric. And in the donor intent language, it says the Institute was to be devoted to the question of whether or not science could provide us with a complete and satisfying worldview without recourse to the supernatural. I mean, that's an interesting thing to talk about, so I don't have any objections to there being an institute like that. And I thought I had some speakers that might come in and want to talk about whether or not science could provide us with a complete and satisfying worldview without recourse to the supernatural, so I suggested that we invite them. And I proposed that we invite them, and I proposed a budget. I sent it into the chair of the committee. 3 hours later, I got a phone call. Okay. Now, the committee had not looked at my proposal in 3 hours. And it's interesting that he called me rather than writing anything down. And he said, we can't fund these speakers. It was, actually, I'll tell you who they were. It was Ted Davis, who's a historian of science at Messiah College, and Justin Barrett, who's a cognitive psychologist at Oxford. Some of you may know one or the other of them. I said, why not? He said, because, you know, these guys are evangelical Christians. And I said, well, yeah, but they're not going to talk about that. I mean, one of them's going to give a talk about sort of what happened at the Dover trial on intelligent design. That's, I mean, it's an interesting historical episode, especially to people in central Pennsylvania where I am. And Justin Barrett was going to talk about the cognitive science of religion. And I said, you know, they're not. But he said, yeah, but you know what? But their beliefs inform what they do and their scholarship, and they don't. They can't sign on to the donor intent. You know, they think that you can't have a satisfying worldview without recourse to the supernatural. I said, yeah, but I thought the whole idea here was that these are ideas to be discussed, right? We have some people are advocating for it, and some people are criticizing it. Is this just supposed to be an ideological mouthpiece for one point of view? And he said, yeah, that's pretty much the way I see it. So he said, I'm not even going to bring this to the committee. You're not having them. So I thought, well, now hold on a minute here. So this is one place where it seemed to me that a $1 million gift really could run the risk of interfering with the progress of the kingdom of God on my campus. So I went and talked to the provost about it. Provost I mentioned last night, by the way. And she said, no, I don't have any problem with this. And I said, so you mean like if Jerry Falwell or somebody came in and said, we want to give you $50 million to start the Institute for Fundamentalist Christianity, and each speaker has to sign a statement of faith proclaiming the inerrancy of the Bible and things like that, you'd be fine with that too? And she chose not to answer that question. But in any case, I was told that that was the way it was. I wasn't satisfied with that, and I don't think I should have been. And so at that point, one of my Christian colleagues and I went to the president, and we said, okay, look, this is wrong. At a liberal arts college that's open to the free exchange of ideas, we can't sell ourselves to the highest bidder. So here are the options. Either you do something about this and make sure that this doesn't happen anymore, or we're just going to talk to the press about it. I mean, we're just going to make a big deal about this because it's not right. Well, you know, this was shortly after the big flap at William & Mary about the, I don't know if you followed this, but about the removal of the cross from this one building and many millions of dollars in lost donations as a result from alumni. He didn't want to have that sort of thing. And I don't like to arm twist people, but I think there are times when you think the integrity of the gospel is on the line and you have to do something and you have to be a thorn. I have no idea how long I've gone. Way over time, right?
Probably.
Okay. So I'm going to stop there. But just some examples to think about. I like telling stories when we're thinking about it. Oh, he did? Yeah. So he went to the committee. Now, I'll tell you this. I haven't gone back to challenge it yet. That is, I haven't gone back and tried to submit names of other speakers. So it may not be over. But I think, you know, there are times when you have to, when you're moved to act, and you have to do it judiciously.
We have time for comments on what's been said or questions about other roles that Christian faculty are able to engage in on campus, and the floor is yours.
Mike, can I be very unfair and ask you how you decided that was the role you wanted to talk about?
Yeah. How I decided that was one of the ones? Well, here's the reason. You know, there's actually a very long story associated with this whole institute. It goes back a few years, and here's the part of the story that I won't tell you about, but you'll think, there's got to be a big story there. I was actually the first chair of this institute, the Atheist Institute, I call it. And it was sort of weird. I mean, I got picked by accident. The provost didn't really realize what he was doing. But what happened after I was no longer the chair of the institute. I didn't get fired, just in case you're wondering, but was that the committee took a decided turn in favor of speakers who were openly hostile to religious belief. And so people like Ann Druyan, who's Carl Sagan's wife, was one of the first of a long series of speakers who came in. And the remarks that were made during these talks, which were all very well attended, were very unfair towards religious belief. I mean, it was just holding up religious belief for ridicule. And I thought, you know what, we can't allow this sort of thing to go on. If they want to bring in speakers who are going to treat the gospel in that sort of way, then they have to allow alternative points of view to be heard. And if they weren't going to, you could see where this was going to go over the long run. And I just couldn't let that happen.
Yeah. I was curious if you were this thorny of a thorn before you
went. If what? Can you say it again?
If you were such a sharp thorn before you had
before you got tenure.
You know, I will, maybe this is self-deception, but I don't think I've changed in this regard from before tenure to after. And so I think I did something now looking back that I think was a little foolish. So I'll tell you what it was. There was a, I forget what the context was. There was some series of letters. It was shortly after the, this is going to sound like I'm a Johnny One Note here. It's just, I don't know why this example comes up, but there was the founding, it was the year in which they founded the LGBTA on campus. And so there's a lot of letters being circulated about it. I don't have any problem with there being such a group. But one of the deans of the college, the dean of multicultural affairs, decided to circulate. It was a, maybe you read it. It was a letter to the editor of the LA Times, written by Jimmy Carter, and it was talking about issues of the treatment of gays in American culture. It was really well written, and it was quite tolerance minded. And she was actually passing it around as something that she thought was exemplary. But at the end, she provided her own commentary in which she said something like this. This is a nice antidote to the typical remarks by Christians who, as we all know, are homophobic, bigoted, racist. And she went on to give this long list of pretty insulting remarks, you know. And I thought, well, it's one thing. If people want to trade remarks like this in the pages of the college newspaper, you know, there's nothing you can do about it. But here you've got someone who has it as her official position to represent the college's view on multicultural issues. I just couldn't live with that. And so I decided to write a fairly long opinion piece for the college newspaper in the next week, in which I said, you know, name-calling just isn't appropriate in this kind of, when it comes to this sort of topic. And saying that, you know, Christians are bigot, racist, all these sorts of things. You know, if you've got a particular point of view and you want to defend it, then stand up and do it. And if you want a Christian to stand up and defend their point of view on this topic, you know, I'm happy to do that. But let's not have any of the name-calling stuff go on. That led to a lot of nonsense. And I had some faculty members that literally had with whom I'd been friends who'd walk by me on the sidewalk for years and would not even say hello. I didn't say anything that I thought was offensive, but I just thought, you know, that crosses the line. And I made it anyway, but you know, you never know in a case like that.
Let me ask Dora what she thinks about her style, which sounds very good to me, at a general institution, a secular institution. Modifications required or scrapping the whole thing?
Yes. Definitely modifications required. I mean, I don't know that I would, yeah. Sort of move in the Anselmian direction in a classroom at a secular institution. I did do, I was a course assistant and taught classes at the University of Chicago, so I have some experience in that mode. I think there it can be a matter of sort of choosing, again, the approach, the way in which you teach. The discipline of English, at least, affords you a variety of ways to think about literary texts. One of the reasons I loved Moser's, your piece about the questions we ask was its emphasis on being person-oriented in the kinds of research questions we ask. I think that applies to how we think about or teach literature, being person-oriented both in terms of relating to the students, but also in how we talk about authors, how we talk about literary texts, how we talk about characters. I think that's those kinds of choices that you make as a teacher in the classroom, I think, can shape students' perceptions and experiences. So, I think the project too of talking about various kinds of approaches to the discipline in the classroom is still available, but the kinds of emphases that you would give would be less religiously specific. But you could point in the direction of the affirmation of authorial agency or the agency of persons, as opposed to the dominance of systems or the circulation of social energy or whatever, you know, whatever kind of phrase you want to get. I think there are still those kinds of choices, and I think the opportunity to make visible to the students the variety of approaches and the choices that they can make is still one that would be very good to take. And again, this is what Jerry Graff, I think, has been sort of talking about for years, that part of the incoherence, where's Hal, sort of part of the incoherence of English needs to not be bracketed in the classroom, but needs to be brought in as a matter for discussion with the students, so there isn't a kind of false teaching that there is this univocal voice about what we're doing in the literary classroom, one way or the other, but making that visible, I think, is a great teaching strategy at whatever kind of institution you're in. So, oh, sorry.
Can I turn the question around again? And I want to go back to your community, the Christian institution. And I am one of those students and teachers and all who quite often I stop while I'm reading and pray about it for a while and read and pray about it. And I've wanted to introduce that model to my students, and I've also been a little bit afraid too when I do reading. So it's not that I, you know, not that students couldn't. But I'm wondering, why don't you go that extra step? Or why don't I? I mean, I'm just thinking, why is it that even at our Christian institutions we're afraid to teach that to our students? Yet, we know that many students do it, and it's really
right.
valuable.
Two responses. One is there are different kinds of Christian institutions, right? I think some place like Wheaton, but Baylor is a different animal. There are Christian institutions that don't require a statement of faith from its students, for instance. So at Baylor, I've got people who are Christians, I've got people who are Hindu, I've got people who are Muslims, I've got people who are Jewish. So I don't want the position of professor to be I don't want to impose on them something that they did not sign up for in my class. That's why I have not made the choice to do that. Though I flagged that one could do this if one was taking an Anselmi approach, but I'm not going to subject them to that. At Wheaton, at institutions where you have a population where the majority of the students are Christian, I refused to pray in the classroom at Wheaton on purpose because students expected me to pray in the classroom. There are students who had the idea that the integration of faith and learning means you start class with prayer. You sort of baptize the class by praying before class, and then whatever happens in class is Christian. And I just think that's not what it means to integrate faith and learning. So I refused to pray in class. I said, look, praying, we're not reading Shakespeare devotionally here. You know, that's not what we're doing. Okay, we want to talk about the sonnet. We want to talk about the structure of the sonnet. We want to talk about, you know, imagery. There are other kinds of, you know, Hal mentioned craft, right? There are things we need to talk about as students of English literature, and being devotional in class about literature was the knee-jerk response. So I think it's all contextual. I think it's what's the institutional culture, what are students expecting and used to, where do you need to push and move them. So I think it all depends on where you find yourself. So I think there's that element, but I also think I appreciated the Hauerwas piece as a way of urging us to think about his phrase, being intellectually interesting. Let's not just do what everyone else does. Let's think about ways of being different. But I think the ways of being different are going to look different depending on where we find ourselves.
Yes. I'm curious about. I'm a TA in a secular institution, and I've never, you know, come out in my class and said, "Hey, I'm Christian." And so I just wondered what your approaches are on that, or how do you think professors should have students know that they're Christian, or how does it play a role in the work? Sort of talk about religious themes, or should you say, "Hey, I'm a Christian, and we should do that"? Because
we're
going to alienate some of the students who are with you until that point.
Michael,
you should take that one.
Yeah, I don't have a rule about this, so let me think what the answer to that question is. So, for example, I just taught a seminar in the fall on evolutionary and psychological approaches to the origin of religion, and in that class. Well, I mean, I'll just say this first of all. In courses that involve a lot of, you know, majors and so on, at a small institution, you know, for the most part, people know, oh, that's the religious guy. I mean, there's no secret there. That course actually had a lot of people, students that, you know, didn't know me in advance, and I didn't do this intentionally, but I thought, you know, maybe I didn't see any particular reason to let them know my own angle at the beginning. And so we just looked at these, you know, views, many of which have glosses on them provided by the evolutionary theorist or the psychologist that they think this has negative implications for the integrity of religious belief. I just ignored those, you know, and we just sort of went through and looked at the views. When we got to the end, though, and we started talking about philosophical implications of the views, I said, look, before we go any further, you know, because a lot of them, I think, had begun to be nervous about this. There were students who had religious convictions, and they started to think, what this research shows us is that our brains or our genes trick us into being religious. And, you know, I could sense from them that they were concerned about that. And so I said, I'll just tell you right off the bat here, I myself am an evangelical Christian, so my approach to this topic is in part informed by that, but I don't see that these negative implications follow from this at all. And you could see some people just like breathe a sigh of relief, right? Like, because I was getting nervous, you know. So in some cases, I'll hold off for a while. I think it does. And what's interesting is when you get to that point, sometimes late in the semester, if you've been doing your job correctly, I think, students will say, huh, I never would have guessed that. You know, I mean, it sort of looks like you're just taking this stuff straight up, and you are. I mean, you're just trying to understand the, and engage the ideas and look at the arguments for and against, and I think they really appreciate the fact that, you're dealing straight with them. But there have been some classes where early on I tell them what my point of view is, in part because I do want them to filter the material. That way. And in part, I want them to be on guard. I don't want them to think I'm trying to trick them into something at the end. Right? It's only revealing my commitments at the end, and then they're having to go back through their what they've heard and think, oh, well, no, wait, now what do I have to go filter out? Well, what this guy said, you know, because now I know that he's brought these commitments to bear. So I'm not sure that's really helpful, but sometimes I just tell them right up front, and sometimes I wait. And I think at some point, though, that always becomes an item of discussion. It's just in part is the kind of stuff that I teach. You know, it's natural for people at some point to lay their cards on the table, and I don't think there's any problem in doing that.
You know, I think that it's okay to start even in the secondary. I used to teach at Michigan State, and it's okay to begin classes with the observation that there is no such thing as an ideological Switzerland. You know, place where there's nothing at stake, where everything's neutral. Many classes are taught from particular positions. It's very well known, and whether it's queer theory or it's a women's studies class or African American literature class or Marxist approaches and so forth and so on. So I think this is actually maybe one of the advantages of moving into a sort of postmodern environment where we can make our commitments known. I happen to teach mostly 19th century literature, but also spiritual literatures. And I think it's useful for them to know that, you know, those are loaded classes. When you teach Harriet Beecher Stowe, she's very outspoken about her faith. And I just want you to know that I'm a Christian, and I have some sympathies with many of her points and disagree with her on many other things. So I think it's, in all fairness to you as my students, I think it might be useful for you to know where I'm coming from. Because actually what I don't like, and I tell students this, I don't like it when people hide their agendas. Not that I have an agenda, but I have beliefs. And it might be useful for you to know where I stand on some of these things.
Just one other quick thing. I think the one danger of laying your cards on the table early is that students feel like they need to patronize you. And so you've got to make it very clear that, that you expect brutal honesty from them. And I tell them, you know, look, most people, most of my colleagues here disagree with me about these things, and I'm not offended by that. And I expect that a lot of you disagree with me on these things. And your grade doesn't depend on that, right? I want you to just say what you think, because that's the way we're really going to have some honest discussion. So because people are afraid to critically engage other people's religious sensibilities generally on campus, you have to make it clear that that's okay if you're going to let them know who you are.
I think it's important to stay away from simple recipes here, because when we look at the New Testament, we have the injunction against casting pearls, but also the injunction to proclaim the good news. We need to hold those two together. We need to use discernment in individual contexts to see how we're being led instead of offering a simple recipe.
Mm-hmm. And I also think along the same lines is, we have to really contest their stereotypes of what it means to be a Christian, a Christian person, a Christian intellectual. And, you know, I think it's really good for them to see that, okay, I confess as a Christian, but some of my views are probably going to blow your mind. We're doing a 60s class here. I like John Lennon. What? Okay, we're reading Walt Whitman. What? I thought you were a Christian. You know, Walt. You know, so I think that you know, it's important to note the wide differences. You go into any church in America and ask 100 people, what do you think about gay marriage? What do you think about abortion? What do you think about AIDS in Africa? What do you think about feeding the poor? You're going to get a lot of different answers. And
yes, in the back.
Yeah, Michael, you teach at a private liberal arts college with a relatively small student population, and Dora teaches at a private Christian university. You know, obviously it's difficult to talk about hypotheticals, but what do you think would be different about your approaches if you were at a large public university, you know, say University of Illinois, where there's a different dynamic? I don't know what experiences you've had in those kind of areas, but there are some things that you know, become more difficult to do and maybe more possible to do. So I wonder if you have had any thoughts about that.
You're pausing because you want me to go first?
Well, no, I can. I mean, I'll just go back to my University of Chicago experience, which is not a public, as a different kind of place altogether. But I think there, Michael's emphasis on being available to students, I think, is something that can speak very loudly at institutions where students often feel like they're falling through the cracks and not being attended to by faculty, and faculty who care about students, who care about students' writing, who care about their academic development, who make time, who show up for office hours, who are available. I think that kind of strategy can speak loudly to students. That's a different kind of tack than talking about what's actually going on in the classroom. So, I think the element on attention to persons and attention to students as individuals is something that that could go a long way in an institution that's enormous and where students often feel invisible or not attended to the way they might be in a smaller institution.
Well, let me add one other thing. I'm not sure where you're really going with that question. I mean, why you invoke state institutions in particular. But I do know that some of my good friends who teach at state institutions feel like they labor under quite different rules. And sometimes people who have tried to stretch the rules a little bit really have been burned, even people with tenure. And I can give you specific examples of people who were outspoken about their beliefs in the classroom, tenured professors who really paid the price. I mean, were taken out of positions of, maybe you think this is not paying a price, taken out of administrative positions that they had. Actually, in this case, it was, in the one case I'm thinking of now, really what did take a toll on the individual and their salary and lots of other things, for remarks that, I would have regarded as pretty innocent if I were making them in my own classroom. So I think you've got to tread very carefully, and I think it in part depends on your chair and on the dean who oversees what you do. Because students, at state institutions, students are very quick, at least in some places, to rat you out if you want to talk about your personal religious convictions in class. And if you don't have buffers upstream, you've got to be very careful.
Just if I could just follow up on that. I'm at a Roman Catholic institution. If a person before tenure had gone public with the kind of statement that Michael made, that person would not get tenure in the philosophy department. There's no chance.
What kind of statement?
Pardon? Of the statement regarding immorality of homosexuality.
They would not.
They would not. If the department knew that you held that position, you would not get it.
Now, why is that?
I mean, because of the colleagues, because of the political climate in what is largely a secular department in the Jesuit institution.
So in other words, is it liberal?
They would vote
yeah.
against you.
Tenure.
It's all anonymous secret ballot.
So take whatever. The temperature of things when you arrive.
Oh, a couple of things. One is, many years ago, I was teaching for two semesters, pretty much the same group of students, same class, sequence of world literature, ending up with 20th century. And at the end of the class, a couple of really bright women students back in the room raised their hands, and they called on and said, we figured out what you are. Now, I've been teaching a worldviewishly about the various worldviews that come through the literature in the periods. You are an existential Calvinist. I thought, yeah, that's pretty close. The other point I want to make is that at the University of Northern Illinois, I don't know Weston, it's a lot like Franklin Marshall, but not quite as advanced toward sheer atheism. And there was that this was the time of the radical movement in the student world, 1971, the spring of 1971, the U.S. just bombed Cambodia. Students went up, the camps went up for grabs. I went to teach my Shakespeare class and my Milton class, and I said, I can't do that. The atmosphere in the school just simply wouldn't fit. So I gave up about hour and work class. I gave about a half hour analysis of where I thought things were. And let the students then respond. Where are you on all this sort of thing? We just had a dialogue, not about Shakespeare and Milton, but about the student situation. One student afterwards said, you know, if the rest of our campus would do this, one of our teachers would do this, we wouldn't be out there rioting. Another one said, by the way, have you heard of Francis Schaeffer? So it is possible, under some circumstances, yeah. It would seem to me to almost be required. Virginia Tech just recently. Yeah. It would almost be required.
I just wonder, we've been talking about the idea of a forum, like Veritas forum, and that sort of thing. Do you think if that gives Christian Koch a platform, a venue for speaking, you know, it can create the legitimacy of a Christian voice on the campus. We find it works well in Canada. Do you think it would work in your campus? Because in some ways, you can't use your lecture for stating religious views, but if you're given that opportunity to speak about faith and academics mm-hmm. on discipline, then you have a mandate, in a sense. The mandate is created by the para, you know, the extracurricular and academic event. And I don't know.
This is good.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think one of the things that I'm pretty committed to at Franklin and Marshall is bringing in a steady stream of high-profile Christian scholars to share their thoughts on a variety of different topics. Not exclusively. I mean, I invite lots of different people to campus. But I think, for me, it's important that that voice continue to be a part of the conversation. And sometimes, you know, that stirs up trouble, too. I was telling Jim, I ran this series a few years ago. It was on something on faith and science, I guess. It must have been the theme. But one of the speakers was Owen Gingrich, who's at Harvard. Some of you probably have read some of his stuff. And he gave this talk to a packed house of 400 people in the room, which for a 2,000-student institution is a lot. Actually, that was all that would fit. And it was this talk. Some of you might have heard it. It's a chapter in his recent book with the same title, Dare a Scientist Believe in Design? And during the Q&A, someone asked him a question about how he thinks about design and science, or whatever it was. But anyway, the comment he made at the end of his remarks in answering this question was something like this: well, for me, the purposiveness of the universe is really summed up in the incarnation, life, death, and resurrection of Christ. And as I told Jim, it was the first time ever, and since, that I've heard someone audibly gasp in an academic lecture. Someone went, like they couldn't believe it. And so I thought that was great. I mean, that was, somebody really was moved, you know. They heard what he was saying, and I thought it was really a great thing. There was actually some interesting follow-up later and some of the science faculty from that. But I think it's a good thing to do. You know, there are lots of great Christian scholars out there. Sometimes it's tough to find the funding. But I say search around for it and use it strategically.
Yes. This may, unfortunately, this may take a step back from that, but I'm wondering if any of you have found ways to conceptualize teaching ethically or in a way that kind of walks in that reconciling all things way, but that doesn't explicitly have to be Christian in order to reach secular students. So I was thinking that this last semester I was teaching first-year students who I noticed were very tired and stress, and I found myself constantly urging them to take a whole day where they didn't touch their homework, where they just rested. And I realized after a while, I'm like, wow, I'm teaching them to take Sabbaths. That's really what I'm doing. And I think I even at one point referred to, you know, we need to not be slaves to homework. Like, that's important to be free from that. So I'm wondering if you guys, in your experience, especially if you've been in situations where you're just not able to explicitly name Jesus, but if you found ways to conceptualize, you know, teaching ethics,
Christian ethics,
and wisdom, that would help, that would be accessible
to
non-Christians.
Hal, looks like you actually had something to say about that. Did you want to? Well,
I think that, you know, fiction lends itself to being taught ethically or morally. And so I actually think I do that all the time. I mean, American literature is kind of shot through with ethics. And shot through with purpose and drivenness and meaning and all these things. So, and in those cases, of course, when you ask a student, well, what's the overall moral factor? ethical effect of Moby Dick or the Scarlet Letter or something like that, you don't have to name Jesus Christ at all. It's just we're asking to conceptualize this work of art in its entirety, and people are going to have a variety of responses to that. But of course, that's how we're, I think, that's how we're kind of designed to think about these things. So I think that the ethical criticism of fiction, Wayne Booth's style or Robert Cole's style, that sort of thing is very appropriate and actually leads to wonderful discussions.
But I love this, what you were talking about. I don't see who asked the question, this notion of Sabbath and sort of speaking about that in a way that can communicate to others. I think also how we talk about our syllabus and the practices you expect of your students. You can talk in terms of intellectual virtues, right? What we expect for conduct in the classroom, how we talk to one another, how students respond to each other, timeliness, their ethic of research and you know, citing things and not stealing. I mean, there's the whole sort of setup of the class enables you, I think, to think ethically and talk to students about virtue and the practices of intellectual virtues in class. And I think that's a very fertile direction to go as well.
Our time is up. The rooms begin at 4 o'clock. Philosophy is in the Houston room, which is somewhere.
Somewhere around that way.
Lit people are back here. The history people are next door in panel room G. And we should thank our panelists for that.